21CL Radio. You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassar.
Welcome to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassley. To give you a bit of insight into my show, the main purpose behind this podcast is to share stories from the world of education and beyond of people who strive for both personal and professional excellence in their life. Every one of my guests has a passion and a desire to make a difference in the world through their work. Regardless of what they do, be it professional sports, music, art, coaching, writing books, educational leadership, or public speaking, what separates them from the ordinary is their ability to look within and to reflect on both their strengths and their weaknesses and to do the hard work necessary to become a master of their craft. Each of them has developed a very strong mental framework that helps to guide their own journey of learning and discovery, ultimately pushing them to pursue both personal and professional excellence in their life. In today's episode, I feel very fortunate to have interviewed Simon Dyson. Simon, who is from England, was a 17-year veteran of the European Golf Tour, having won 6 times in Europe and 3 times in Asia. Simon played in 20 majors over the years, having made the cut in 9 of them. Anyone who knows and understands the game of golf knows just how hard it is to qualify for a major, let alone make the cut. Simon played in 2 Masters, 4 US Opens, 9 Open Championships, and 5 PGA Championships. His best showing in a major was in the 2009 Open Championship, which was held at Royal St. George's Golf Club, where he finished 9th place. His best world ranking was in 2012, when he was ranked number 26 in the world. One can only imagine the hard work that a professional athlete has to put into their game in order to develop the physical and mental skills necessary to compete at such an elite level. In this episode, Simon digs deeply into his own journey and the mental framework that he developed and applied that not only helped him achieve great success, but also helped him to get through some of the lower points in his career. Simon's journey with the game of golf began by his father taking him to a nearby school along with his brother to hit some golf balls at the age of 10. Simon was captivated by the game right away and would go on to become a scratch player by the age of 15 and represent England in the Walker Cup in 1999. Simon began his professional career in Asia and through a very hard work ethic and the support of his coach, Pete Cowan, he was able to have a breakthrough year as a rookie, winning 3 times in his first season. This led him back to Europe and a spot on the European Golf Tour. He would go on to play 17 seasons on this tour. Unfortunately, a serious wrist injury sidelined him in the 2015 season, and upon returning to the game, Simon had difficulty getting back on track. However, in knowing his career as a tour player was coming to a close, he wanted to redefine his purpose and to find new meaning in his life. This led Simon to change career paths and become a coach. He now wants to give back to the game by mentoring others and working with them to unlock their potential with the game of golf. Simon not only works on the physical skills necessary to play the game, but also the mental skills required to bring on peak performance. In this conversation, Simon shares his authentic self, his ups and his downs, and how he has always been able to stay focused in order to fulfill his potential and the vision he has for the future. Simon also discusses the work he is now doing with his elite golf performance school, which is also known as the Simon Dyson Academy. I really enjoyed this discussion, and I sincerely hope that you find takeaway value that you can apply in your own life. With that, let's jump right into this discussion with Simon Dyson.
Okay, Simon, people have already heard about you in the introduction. They've heard about your career. They've heard about the successes that you've had and what you're doing now. And in advance to the conversation that we're going to have right now, I want to really genuinely thank you for your time and energy and for being willing to be on my show.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for asking me to do it.
Yeah. So again, I want to start with early days. And I know you picked up the game of golf around 8 or 9 years old. But can you just talk about the role of physical activity in sport and what role that played in your life actually before even playing golf?
Yeah, we're a big sporting family. My dad was a professional footballer. His brother was a professional footballer and played for Spurs, which is a big team here in England. And they won the 60-61 Cup.
Oh, wow.
His son's a professional tennis player. One of his other sons played cricket. So we're a big sporting family. So sport was a massive deal for us. And my dad introduced me to, you know, different sports from an early age. I used to love tennis and football. They were my two real sports that I loved playing. And then it was my brother who got me into golf. He came home one day, and I think a lot of his friends were members of a golf course close to us, and he wanted to join, even though we'd only messed about in school fields, hitting from goalpost to goalpost, things like that. But yeah, sport, massive part of my family, a massive part of my growing up.
Which obviously paves the way. Like, obviously, if that's as important as a role that sport played with the background and your dad playing, and you said your cousin played tennis, pro
he
tennis.
He was Davis Cup squad member, yeah, for Great Britain.
So you're around a sporting mindset, which makes a huge difference.
Massive.
Yeah. And then going into, so just tell the story again about your dad bringing your brother to the school, to your brother wanted to try out for a golf team or get a membership. Just share that story and how they brought you along and the start.
It literally was like that. I mean, my brother's friends were members of Moulton and Norton Golf Club and came home one day from school and he said, "Dad, I want to join the golf club." I think I was 10. He'll have been, you know, 13, 14. And my dad said, "Right, let's go to the school field. If you can hit it half decent," he said, "I'll join you," because it was not much to join the junior program back then. And they're leaving the house, and my dad turned to me and went, "Do you want to come as well?" I was like, "Yeah, all right." Mm-hmm. Anyway, we took us to both to the school field, and we both could hit it half decent, to be fair. And he joined us both, and that was it. I just straight away fell in love with the game. I mean, it was summer holidays, 54 holes a day, 7 days a week.
And was it you, like, you know, there's lots of stories about these young prodigies that pick up a club and they're given every single advantage in life and every top instructor, and they have everything given to them. Did you figure it out on your own in those initial couple years? Did you have some coaches? Like, what was it like for you, and what factors contributed to your early success learning the game so quickly?
I think there was a junior program. There was a couple of guys, Morris Wade and Alan Haig. They were a couple of guys who really kind of took me under the wing. And Alan, I mean, I still speak to Alan Haig now, and he said, like, to this day, he said, for a lad who just started the game, he always says, "I've never seen it, and I've never seen it since. Like, you just knew how to play the game." And he said, "I could tell you had that competitive edge. I used to get quite angry, and even at 10 or 11, because I knew I could do better." And then I started getting coaching from the club pro, who is now an England coach, a guy called Steve Robinson. And he helped me massively in my early days, massively. He got me, you know, straight away thinking about the game just a little bit differently instead of just playing.
So it felt like when you stood over the ball, you started to make contact, and in particular, you know, not forcing it up in the air, just letting it happen naturally. How did that feel in your development, like kind of feeling out those shots and kind of learning how to play?
It was great. It was great. I used to love it. I used to love, because like we know, no two shots are ever replicated. You could think you've got the same shot, but there'll be different factors coming in. The wind might be a bit stronger. I have to take a bit of spin off this. So all the time you're adjusting. And I loved that part of the game. Like using my imagination and really working the ball, should I say. Which is why when you look at the tournaments that I've won, a lot of them are on links courses where you really have to work the ball. So yeah. I love that part of it. And, you know, a lot of people strive for perfection and the perfect ball flight. I was totally the opposite. I really have fun.
Which is huge, you know, the enjoyment of the game from an early age.
Massive. It's huge in the development of a player. I mean, I think now, you see these players come out, it's like they're coming off a conveyor belt and they all just do the same thing. Whereas all of a sudden you get one that breaks the mold and you just see them soar.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you talk about, I heard you say, so you were a scratch by the age of 15. And
yeah, 15, early 16, something like that.
Yeah. And can you talk about those years, like 15 to 19, because they were pivotal years and you represented England. I really want to dig deep, because this to me is one of the most important times that I'm trying to emphasize, not only in your life, but in any kid's life who's trying to pursue excellence in something, whether they be an artist, whether they be a musician, whatever it is. And what I want to ask you is, like, what were the beliefs that you held about yourself, and how did you kind of deal with, I want to go more into failure later, but how did you learn to deal with failure in a way that didn't hold you back, but propel you forward?
It's funny. Now you mentioned it, I look at like the disappointments that I've had, and I just had a really, I'm quite feisty, and I just had a really good way of putting this, almost helping me strive that little bit harder. You know, I never played for England boys. I felt I deserved to. And that really like helped me progress to go, right, I'm definitely going to make the men's team. And then I played for Yorkshire. He played for Yorkshire boys. I mean, my record was as good as anybody's in the country, but they just didn't seem to want to pick me for England boys. And then we started winning all the Yorkshire event, the England man team, still wasn't getting picked. And then I played the English amateur. And I always say you need a bit of luck. You need a bit of luck in your life, whatever you're doing, to then take advantage of it. And I've always done that. And English amateur, he's got a 4-foot putt to knock me out on the 18th hole of the first round. He misses it. I knock it out of bounds on the first playoff hole. He makes six. We half the hole. And then I beat him. And I got to the semi-final. And all of a sudden, I get recognised for England. They ring me up. Can you go to Greece, play in the Greek amateur? I finished second behind Henrik Stenson. Can you go to the Spanish... I can't remember the name of it now, but it was like a Spanish amateur. Finished third there. And then all of a sudden, I get my first England cap and I was unbeaten for England. So
that's amazing.
Took full advantage of it.
And what do you consider to be the, you know, when you reflect back on those early days, you probably had a lot of strong parts of your game, but in terms of your physical skills with the game, not so much mental, because you said you were feisty, you were a competitor, you lived on, you know, showing, maybe not showing people that they were wrong, but just you lived on those situations. But what were the best physical parts of your game?
Definitely off the tee. Off the tee has always been a massive strong point. Very rarely get myself in trouble. And I think
flight path draw.
I used to hit a draw. And I think the important putts, the clutch putts, I always seem to make them. Even after, I remember playing a GB&R game and I'm level playing the last hole and this lad's thinned it to the back of the green and I've hit it 6 foot. He must have a 50 footer down two tiers and he holed it. And I stepped up to it and I just thought, I can't miss this because there's no way I'm going to lose this game. I've absolutely played him off the park. And I holed it and everyone was like, flipping out, that was a big putt for you there. But I honestly believed I was going to hole it.
But being in that situation, and you hear a lot of stories about golfers who have, you know, they're amazing off the tee. They've got great irons. They get to the green and they shit the bed and they stand over putts. And the last thing they want to do is pull the trigger because they tense right up. But it sounds like you actually thrived. You looked at the hole.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it. And you had this looseness probably in your stroke, right? No tension. And
so I always think when you're on a putting green, what you're trying to do, you're trying to hole a putt. You're trying to hole the putt. Yet when you're on the course, sometimes you're thinking, don't miss. And there's a massive difference there. Massive difference. When you just see the hole, it's such a good mindset to be in. But there's a lot of the green to miss the hole. So if you're seeing don't miss, you know, that's why you see a lot of good putters three putt, because they're trying to hole the putt. And it might cost them another shot.
Yeah.
But they'd rather do that than think, don't miss, and still miss. And I think there's a big difference.
Massive, massive. You're target focused. You're
absolutely.
And
I do this thing now at the minute where I line my ball up, and if I have 100% confidence where that line is, and if I roll it end over end, I know the hole has got a very good chance of getting in the way. So I don't look at the hole. I stand over the ball and just think, roll the line.
Yeah, and that's...
stood behind it, getting my pace.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my putting's been the best. I've putted the best I've putted for 5 years just by doing that.
Yeah, and Gary and Carl, so this is a nice time to give a little shout-out to Gary Nicol and Dr. Carl Morris. And, you know, I told you I got some lessons from both of them.
Yeah.
And the things I learned from Gary, and I think you'll appreciate this, is Gary took me out to the putting green and said, show me your pregame warm-up on the putting green. And I got my pocket full of golf balls and I put them all down on the surface.
Damn. And
putting, putting, putting. He's like, what are you doing? How many chances do you get out on the course? And I said, well, one.
That's
He's
true.
Like, throw those balls away. You got one ball. And then he helped me realize the width of the hole. You can bring it into the right edge or the left edge or dead center. So you've actually widened the cup by working on pace, right? And that's what you're...
Absolutely. And how many of us work on pace?
Everybody's line.
Pace is almost as important, if not as important, as line. Don't get me wrong, starting it on lines, you're not going to start on line all the time. But if you've got the pace of the greens, you've got a hell of a lot more chance of holding the putts than if you're just starting it online all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yet no one trains pace. Nobody.
And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Gary and Carl's book, The Lost Art of Putting. And they had no pictures in there. And they chose not to have pictures because they didn't want to put a snapshot of what something should look like in a golfer's
head. Specific thing, yeah. On what you... Just let your imagination run wild.
Yeah, I love it, love it. And, you know, I want to segue into your first attempt at the European Tour was when I think you were 21 years old. And
it was.
Yeah, you made it through the first round, right?
Yeah, I think I got to second stage, went down to Spain, and I just didn't play very good. I'd had a long year in 1999. I played Walker Cup, which was, for me, the pinnacle of amateur golf. Which, yeah, I absolutely loved. That was my goal, to get in the Walker Cup team. And I did. So it was great. I didn't win anything as an amateur apart from the Finnish amateur. And that was literally, I got the phone call to say I was playing in the Walker Cup on the Saturday. I flew to Finland on the Sunday and then won the tournament.
Ah, that's amazing.
How crazy is that? And that was my only ever win as an amateur.
Who were some of your teammates on that team?
Oh, I had a good team. I had Paul Casey, Luke Donald, Graham Storm, Lorne Kelly, Phil Rowe. I mean, at one point, there was 10 of us. At one point, we all had either a European Tour or a PGA Tour card.
Oh, that's great.
Like 2002 or 2003, something like that. We all had a European Tour card.
And when, you know, you were unsuccessful, so now we're looking at dealing with failure. And yeah. Your coach, Pete Cowan, said, I think from what I understand of your story, you wanted to stay in Europe and maybe give it another go, but Pete convinced you to go to Asia. So you went over to Asia with, I think you said, 9 other players or something. Yeah. They all missed it. You stayed with it. And then things really started to roll. So talk about that experience, because what I'm interested in knowing is your mindset going into Asia, because you had just experienced failure with not getting your card in Europe. Now you're in Asia and you start really, really finding your own game.
Yeah.
So talk about that experience qualifying, first of all.
So, yeah, we went over to, we flew into Singapore, went to Johor Bahru, just over the water from Singapore. There was about 9 of us went. We all got a house together. I remember the house. I remember my bedroom. And it was like, you know, 19 years ago. And I remember it like I could walk into it now. And it was just a brilliant experience. Went over there, first time I'd been to Asia. It was boiling hot, but people had told me how it was going to be. So I prepared well for it. I went, you know, went in the sauna quite a lot before I went out there, prepared myself for the heat. But Pete had full confidence and he did it. He did it right. He got me a little bit of money to go and play it, to qualify. He got me a caddy who he thought, he knew at the time, would help me out massively. A guy called John Roberts, used to run marathons and stuff. So food and hydration wise was brilliant.
Yeah.
First stage, 200, 100 on course A, 100 on course B, 15 from each. And I got through. I think I finished about 9th, something like that. I played really nice. So all of a sudden, everybody did want to Singapore, and I was just there left on my own.
How did that feel? Did you feel?
It was weird. It was weird because I'd spent 2 weeks with these lads, and we'd become good friends. And but I just thought, you know what? I'm here to do a job, and we prepared for the second stage just like we did the first stage. It was a lot easier with second stage, a lot easier. And I played okay and got through. And then obviously final stage, we played on the Thursday. I was 5 under through 6.
Wow.
Thunderstorms came in and then wiped the whole day.
Ah.
So I'm like, and I remember saying to my caddy, can't believe it. And he just said to me, Dice, he went, you've done it today. What's say you can't do it again tomorrow? And I was 5 under through 6 the day after.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
So you just carry,
realize,
you just carry that momentum.
Absolutely. And it's like I try and make some of my players now. I always say to them, can you birdie every hole? And they're like, well, yeah. Can you hit the fairway? Yeah. Can you hit it close? Can you hold the putt? Yeah. So you've got 18 birdie chances out there. And that's kind of what he made me realize. You've done it once. Why can't you do it again? What's to say you can't? And I did. And I finished 2nd in the qualifying school, which earned me about $1,800. I thought I was the king of the world. I really did. But it got me top 3, got an invite into the Malaysian Open, which was the European Tour event.
Yeah, that's huge. And what I really appreciate, I don't mean to cut you out there, but what I really appreciate is that in your story, you talk very fondly about the early days on the Asian Tour when you were qualifying and that sense of family and that sense of belonging and community and support. And it seems to me like that really allowed you, catapulted you forward to be able to thrive and to play your best, right?
Absolutely. I mean, on my hand, I could name 4 or 5 guys who really took me under the wing. and really helped me massively. And I know I wouldn't have achieved what I did in Asia that year without them, because for a 21-year-old lad to go out there, if nobody had bothered with me, I'd have probably lasted 4 months and just gone, I'm so lonely, and I'm, you know, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't. It was totally the opposite. They were like, I remember going to India, didn't have a clue what India was like. Yeah. And they took me out. They were like, right, you want to eat this? And this, you know, and I never got ill once. So they must have done something right.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were just brilliant. I'd practice rounds with them. I'd have a week off. They'd invite me up to Thailand to go and spend a week in this hotel that they were in, and we'd go and play a bit of golf. And just brilliant. One of the best years of my life. And a lot's happened since then, like family, kids, but career-wise, it's one of the best years of my life.
Yeah, and you're talking about that idea of, you know, having a social support system in place, which is so critical to, you know, a lot of the work that I do with, you know, not just with teachers, but a lot of the work that I'm doing revolves around mental illness, you know?
Yeah.
And especially with men's health, you know, mm-hmm. and that it is so critical to have a social support network in place, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you know, and having that support network in place, even if it's two people that you know you can count on, that can make such a huge difference. And
massive. Yeah. And I had it in Pete, and that's kind of what I want to bring to my players who I look after. They can ring me whenever they want. They won't have a problem that I haven't been through. So I'll always have a bit of advice for them how to deal with it and what might work best for them. And it's a huge part of it. It's a huge part of it.
Yeah, I believe so strongly in that, and it's such an important thing. And so going into your rookie year now, so you win three times. So you win Macau, you win the Volvo, which was not a European Tour event back then,
yeah.
And then you win the Order of Merit. And you're just firing on all cylinders. And I love this story, and I want you to share a little bit about O'Meara waiting for you. Was O'Meara waiting for you on the 18th when you won the Order of Merit, or was it one of the other victories?
No, so we were in a golf buggy going out for the Pro-Am in Macau. This was my first win.
Yep.
So we're going out to the Pro-Am. He's in the buggy next to us. And he just, we got chatting a little bit. And my caddy said, we want you in the last group on Sunday. We want to play with you. That's our aim. And
yep.
He went, great. He went, let's make it happen.
Yeah.
And I got in the final group, and he was second to last group. And he was there when I finished, when I'd won it. I upped and downed it for birdie to win by two. And we got in. He just said, massive congratulations. He went, I'm sorry I couldn't keep my end of the deal up. But, you know, I'm really pleased for you. And for a 21-year-old lad, watching somebody saying that to you, who you've watched for years and always admired because he's the nicest guy, and he was a hell of a player.
Yeah, fantastic.
It was just, I don't know what it was. I absolutely glowed. And then I went to the following week and went and won that as well, because I was still buzzing from everything. It was like, it's like a dream when you win your first one, because you always think, can I actually do it while I'm playing for my living? And then you finally do. And Macau's a beautiful place as well. So it was an unbelievable week.
Yeah, and I love what O'Meara did, because he had won the Masters at that time. Did he win two Masters or one?
Yeah, I think he won two, didn't he?
I think he did two. And
yeah.
You got a guy who's won two Masters, who's absolutely fulfilling the role as a mentor to others. You
absolutely.
Know? That's such a beautiful thing, because you have some elite athletes who will just turn their nose up on everybody around them. So for him
I can name plenty of them.
Him to stand up to the plate and to do that really speaks volumes to his character.
I'm 42 on Saturday, and I remember it like it was yesterday, because it had that big an impact on me.
Yeah, and that's what they say.
And it took him a minute. It took him a minute out of his day to do it.
Yeah, and that's what they say, is that it's those emotionally charged memories that stick with us, both positive and negative, right?
Yeah.
So that's a perfect example of that. So I want to move into... kind of Now I'm going to dig into the role of failure, because up until now you had experienced failure, but you were able to get through it, and you're gritty and feisty. And then you go from having all of that success in Asia to, I think, as you describe it, going 3 or 4 years without a victory. And one of the things when you went back to Europe and joined the European tour, and I have done some work, and I did a course kind of like Dr. Carl Morris's Mind Factor course, but I did my course with the sports psychologist for the Seattle Seahawks in the NFL.
Okay.
So him and Pete Carroll, the head coach of Seattle Seahawks, created this course called Compete to Create. And that's what I'm going to get my son in next. But
mega.
I did the course.
Is that in the States, that? Is that in the States?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you a link to it.
Please do. Yeah.
Yeah. But in this course, Dr. Michael Gervais, who's the sports psychologist, talks about self-critical thoughts and how for so many years we've been taught to shut them out of our personal and professional life. There's no place for them. Lock the door on them. Don't let them in. But what we do is we fight these things nonstop, and they always find a little crevice to get through, and they never leave us. So what he says, and he teaches his Olympians and his elite athletes, is don't mute self-critical thoughts. Have a relationship with them.
Mm.
Your way through it. Relationship with them.
It's almost talk things through with them, isn't it?
Yeah. So talk about that dry spell. And so that 3 to 4 years where you didn't win, what it was like, how you continued to positively frame the experience, learn from it, and how you might have dealt with any negative self-talk that arose during that time.
It's funny. The first few years were just, again, it was one of those 22-year-old lad traveling the world doing something I enjoyed. So there was hardly any negativity from my side. I used to get it from my dad quite a bit. Because he was like, you're not fulfilling your potential. You know, you've had an amazing year. And it was almost like I took my foot off the gas and I just thought, oh, I'm you know what, I can play this game. I can earn whatever it takes to keep my card every year. It's fine. I want to enjoy myself. And you know what? I'm glad I did. Glad I did, because I had some amazing times with some brilliant lads. And it wasn't until, I mean, again, like I lost my card in 2003, but then my second start on Europe, I got, because I'd won the Volvo China Open, they gave me an invite and I finished second. So it's like, there's your, you know, your negativity, and you do lose your card, the disappointment, but then I bounced straight back again. And then just kind of got set in my ways again for that rest of that year, kept my card. And it wasn't until 2005, Nick Doherty, one of my best pals on tour, had an unbelievable year. He won, and he went from earning 160 grand a year to earning €1 million a year. And I was like, oh my word. So I just sat him down one day and I just went, can I ask you, what have you changed? And he told me what had changed. And he was a big, his nickname was George Best, because he used to love partying. And he just said, I've knocked everything on the head. I'm eating healthy. I'm, you know, at the end of the day, this is my living. So I've had enough of partying. I want to start fulfilling my potential. And I just thought, I'm going to do the same.
Yeah.
I did. I cut out caffeine drinks, because I thought, well, I'm quite an energetic person as it is. Caffeine's just going to make me even worse. I started eating. I started going to the gym twice a day. And all of a sudden, within 3 months, I won the Indonesian Open.
So you physically felt much better.
I felt unbelievable, because I knew I'd come from... I used to finish tournaments and the last 5 holes was like a struggle, because I was on my knees and I was tired. And I went from feeling like that to finishing a tournament thinking I could play again. I could carry on playing. So I was finishing tournaments strong and I was getting the results. And I went again, you know, I won Indonesia and then I won Holland in that 2006 and had an unbelievable year.
And then you went on to KLM back at 2006, 2009. And that led to the Dunhill Links, and you won the Dunhill Links in 2009 at St. Andrews. and by three shots.
Yeah.
And how, you said that that was one of the most special wins that you had. And again, I want to return back to, did you feel a real sense of community there supporting you? What was it that led to that victory, do you think? And how did that, I know you've told the story before, but how did those last few holes feel?
I think it was just, it's not as much of a community in Europe, and it's gone even worse now. But I just remember I was second to last group out with Darren Clark, and last group out was Luke Donald and Rory McIlroy. And I just remember thinking, flipping out, I must be playing well if I'm surrounded by these lot.
Yeah.
And then the first eight holes, seven holes, was literally, I don't even remember what I was thinking. I was literally on autopilot. Birdied the first, birdied the second, parred the third, which is easy, birdied four, five, six, and seven.
Oh, wow.
Six under through seven. And it was just one of those, what do you put, people said, like, what do you put it down to? I was like, I don't know. I just got out of my own way and just let it happen. It was one of those where the hole felt like a dustbin. The fairways felt 100 yards wide, which they are in St. Andrews.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I was not thinking, right, I need to get the club in this position to be able to hit this shot. I just hit the shot.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I've tried to study being in the zone. I played American football in college for 5 years. I was a quarterback and a punter, right? And I can remember those fleeting moments of being in the zone. And it's like you have the whole line in front of you blocking for you. You're back passing the ball. You don't see anything but locking eyes with the receiver, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
There's nothing.
But you almost see it in slow motion as well, don't you?
Totally.
Yeah.
So it's that idea. But we're learning now through sports psychology and peak performance psychology that being in the zone is an absolute trainable skill, you know?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So what have you learned about that, and how you can create the conditions to maybe be in the zone more often?
I think obviously everyone's different. Everyone's very individual. I think the pre-shot routine is massively overlooked in the game of golf. I mean, I did the Carl Morris thing, and he breaks it down into three. Pre-shot, shot, post-shot. He went, do you think if you're good at one, if you're good at pre-shot and you're good at post-shot, what are your chances of being good at the shot? And everyone was like, really good. And he was like, well, why does nobody work on them? They just work on that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you work on that and you're rubbish at that and rubbish at that, how do you know you're going to be good at the shot? And that was the big light bulb moment for me. I bought stuff. Have you heard of a focus band?
No.
It's this thing you wear while you play, and it trains you to learn quiet eye, so in the zone. And I started using it in people seeing the shot they want to hit and then literally stepping up and hitting the shot. And it's so powerful. And it's one of those things, even if it's not that accurate, if you believe it is, you're halfway there.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what Carl says. I love what Carl says. And the work that I did with Carl and Gary, I was mostly interested in that stuff, you know, because I'm a six handicap right now. I used to be a three. I'm struggling to get back. I can hit the ball, but more for me, it's the pre-shot, learning a solid pre-shot routine. And I love the question that you ask yourself, the power of questions. What shot do I want to hit right here? How do I want my body to feel to hit the shot?
Yeah.
And once you know that, you step in and hit it, and then there is no emotion involved. You just accept whatever shot there is.
Absolutely. Do one of the Pierre Nielsen. Say something positive about the shot. Even if you've hit it in the bunker, say something positive about it. Well, I struck it really good. Nice one. You struck it really good. Just started a little left, that's all. But you struck it good. So, you know, and all instead of thinking, I've pulled it in the bunker. I must have done something wrong there. Try and find a positive out of it, because we're too quick to jump on the negativity bandwagon. And yeah. Before you know it, you're 3-6 and you think you're playing terrible, but you're probably not.
Yeah, you're close, right? And yeah. what I like what Carl said about when you hit a bad shot. He said he can identify in tour tournaments and amateur tournaments when he's looking out at the players he coaches, and then he sees their shoulders slumped, and he can tell when they're having a bad round. So he likes to talk about keeping your head above the flag. Have you heard him say that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Such a powerful thing, because it changes your
above the horizon. Yeah. Keep it. Yeah.
And it changes
forward, not
changes your neurochemistry
massively. Yeah. And there's certain players. I always think Lee Westwood's one of these. You would not have a clue if he was 4-under or 4-over. You wouldn't have a clue. His body language doesn't deteriorate if he's playing bad, but it's not, you know, exaggerated like a Pablo Larrazabal if he's playing good.
Yeah, yeah.
These people that think that like the world's against them and all this.
Yeah.
You're just doing more harm to yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I want to segue into the majors, because you were in 20 majors, you made the cut in 9 majors. And I know you've been asked, I want to talk about your mindset in majors, but I really, in growing up, having watched every single Masters from as young as I can remember, knowing every hole like the back of my hand, having never been to the course, I want you to just talk about in 2010 stepping on Augusta for the first time and the emotions you experienced, and what the first day was like walking the course, and those feelings that you had.
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. And I'd been offered a few times to go to the Masters to, you know, go and maybe do a walking around the course with some players and go and watch it. And I always turned it down, because I said, the first time I ever go to the Masters, I want to be playing. And I managed to do that in 2010. And we went there first. It's obviously Houston's the week before the Masters. So I got an invite to play Houston. So I said, why don't we go to Atlanta, go and drive to the Masters and go and play the course. So just me and my caddy went. There was nobody on the course. And it was really cool, because you're playing it in its raw form. I couldn't believe how hilly it is.
Yeah, that's what everybody said.
It's unbelievable. It's frightening how hilly it is. So we played, had a couple of practice rounds, and I loved it. Went and played the tournament, made the cut, flew into Augusta, got there Monday morning, and it was like being at a totally different golf course. There was 20,000 people there, and you're like, oh my word.
Yeah.
When it really hits home, just how big it is. Just how big it is. And it was about, all my family came, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, my brother, my mum and dad, few of my mates, few of my brother's mates, few of my dad's mates. And I just wanted to enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go and enjoy it and play as well as I could. And I loved it. Loved every minute of it. And you'll never forget your first Masters. It's one of those.
If you could go back, and let's say you could go there and just, if you had, you know, if you could get in a time machine, zip right over there and play your favorite shot on that course just for the hell of it, what shot would you want to play?
Well, the one that I remember the most was the 6th, the par 3 on the Friday. I hit a 6-iron to about 2 foot to that back left pin.
Yeah.
And it was just, and I just birdied the 5th, which is one of, I actually birdied 4-5, and then I knocked it stiff on 6. So that little stretch was unbelievable for me. But the 6-iron in. And then the 16th, that, you know, your tee shot on the 16th. Brilliant. I hit the flag. It ricocheted off the flag into the bunker, and I had no shot whatsoever.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're just eyeing it, you're thinking, oh my God, I could literally get a hole in one here if you have a better look. And it went in the bunker.
Yeah. So moving on to the 2009 Open Championship, where you finished low, English player. And that's when Darren Clark won. And, you know, you played some pretty solid golf there too, yeah?
I did. It was one of those. It was, I don't know what it was, Tuesday, Wednesday. I just seemed to find a shot. And I wasn't even, it wasn't nothing technique. It was, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to hit it low and left. And that is all I was thinking all week. Keeping it low, starting it left. One thought in your head that powerful is so good, is so powerful on a golf course when you've got all the elements. And don't get me wrong, I hit some shots and you'd be like, is he a pro? You know, hitting that low and left. But then I hit some where you're like, oh my God, that was unbelievable. And it's just taking the rough with the smooth. You're not going to hit all perfect shots. And it was so tough. And but I had a really good draw. I played with Thomas Bjorn and Gary Woodland.
Yeah.
Thomas Bjorn is the one of the best wind players I've ever seen. And Gary Woodland was just the nicest guy. He bombed it.
Yeah.
I remember hitting a drive down the first and I thought, oh, I hit that all right. Low, running. And he's got 3 wood out. And he's hit this 3 wood and it kind of climbed a little bit. So I'm like, I'd heard he was pretty long. It looked all right, but anyway, we'll get down there and he's still 10 yards past me. And I'm just like, oh my word. I thought I'd hit a decent one. But, and I really enjoyed playing with them too. And then Sunday I played really nice and I got a brilliant up and down on 18 for me to finish top 10, which obviously got me an invite for the following year. But yeah, I remember just winning, finishing top 10. And then we went down to Spain the following week. I just had a really nice week as well. We stayed with Darren Clark's mum and dad in a house. My trainer was there. We were doing things right, having a nice week. And then we went to Ireland 2 weeks later. And we're I remember seeing Darren. He was still drunk, basically. He was clarky. But then on the Tuesday night, my wife told me she was pregnant with our first. And I don't know what it was. I just had this massive calmness about myself. And my attitude that week in Ireland was the best it's ever been. And I won it. And I won the tournament.
In tough conditions.
Again, tough conditions, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Well, I just had a brilliant two-week spell where my attitude was amazing. It wasn't down to... I was swinging it good, but I was just seeing the shots and I was content. Even when I didn't hit a good shot, I was just content.
Yeah, and that relaxes the body and allows you to perform at your best. And you said in an interview with Alex that you wish that, or whoever could just bottle up that outer body experience and sell it would be a multi-billionaire. And I guess it goes back to like, what we know about brain science and what we know about peak performance, it can be replicated if you train yourself a certain way, which is in the mental game. I know we're a bit pressed for time, but I just want to kind of talk about your injury, your wrist injury, and your comeback, and ultimately, being okay with saying now's the time to retire, you know? And when I talked to Coulthard last year, Coulthard talked about he never felt pressure. He just loved being on the course competing, right? And what used to be like an easy 195-yard shot to a tucked pin over water with a 5-iron, suddenly he found himself bricking it. He just hated the feeling. And then slowly he got the chance to do some work with Sky Sports. And then he just jumped on the opportunity when they presented it to him. And I spoke to him about a month and a half ago and I asked him if he misses competing. And he says, absolutely not. Mm. You know, he knows he made the right decision. So talk about your injury, your comeback, and then, you know, what it took for you to kind of finally pull the plug and say you're moving on to something else. And then that will segue us into the last part about the Simon Dyson.
Yeah, the injury was hard. It hurt a lot. I mean, I snapped my sub sheath that holds the tendon in place, and it was so painful. And I was out for 9-10 months, came back. But that was one of those where I found it very difficult to forget about what had happened, because every shot I hit, I was worried it was going to go again.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, I started having very negative thoughts about the shot. Came back. I wouldn't say too early, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to play again.
Physically and mentally? Or both.
Yeah. Both, yeah. Everyone, my wrist specialist kept saying, it's not going to go again. I promise you, it will never go again. But in the back of my head, I'm thinking, it still feels weak and it could go again.
Yeah.
And I just didn't commit to shots. And like Andrew said, you know, an easy high cut to a back right pin all of a sudden was like, I don't know where this is going. I don't know where this is going to go, because I haven't got confidence in my strike and my swing anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny now, if you said to me, like, show me a big high cut, I'd be able to do it, no problem. Weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and coming back was hard, because I just missed cut after cut after cut. I wasn't playing good. I was away from my family all the time. I had 2 years. So before I did it, I finished like 36th on the Order of Merit. And then I did it in 2015, came back 16 and 17 and played. I think I only made about 5 cuts in 2 years.
Yeah.
From missing 2 cuts a year, I went to making 2 cuts a year.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in it. Wasn't in it at all. So I kind of started preparing, because I knew how bad my injury was. And I thought, right, I almost start thinking about what I'm going to do when I finish. So I went to America, went to LA, did my TPI out in America, and then did my NASM, level 2, level 3, level 4, gym instruction, PT, golf fitness. So I went and did all that. And then, yeah, I played challenge till and literally I'd miss a cut and I'd just think, oh, nice one, I can go home now. And as soon as I started thinking like that, I thought, right, I need to start building another path to another career. And I always thought there's so many people, like, especially playing Challenge Tour, I've played with so many guys and I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, how are you still on the Challenge Tour? What's going on with you that you can't make that next step? Because I've played for 17 years on the main tour and you hit it better than 80% of them. So what's going on with you that can't get you over that next step? And do you know what? All of it's
right upstairs. There. Upstairs, right?
It is.
Yeah. I what I appreciate about your story is, and I mean this like with 100% sincerity, is that, you know, you experienced the success that you did, and for you to want to stay in the field and to give back in a different way is really commendable, and to have greater purpose. And one of the things that I've learned in my own life, going through some of the things that I've gone through, you know, like I've lost a brother to drug addiction. I lost another brother to suicide from major depression.
Wow.
And what I learned is, when I tried to figure out, you know, like what was it that I was given that they weren't, you know, like I could have so easily gone down that path. And for me, I found purpose through sport. And then when I was done playing American football and golf, I played competitively. I realized that I always had that purpose. I was surrounded with excellence, you know, people pursuing excellence. And that led me to ultimately pursue a path in education and to now train and coach teachers, which is, that's my purpose. So for you to continue to have purpose gives so much meaning in life, you know, and that's what I want to segue into is like, you know, this is a great way for you to talk about how your purpose has shifted and you want to give back to the game and talk about the Simon Dyson Academy, what your hopes are, what your vision is with it, and, you know, just the vision you have for it.
So, yeah, it was just something I'm quite passionate about. I believe that, like you say, I've been in the sport so long and I've achieved quite a bit in it. And I just look at all the best parts about it and then the worst parts. The worst, not the worst parts, but for me, like, you know, you've got your coach, you've got your manager, you've got your agent, you've got your fitness guy. And when it's all going swimmingly, they're all there. But that's not the time when you need them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just think there's so many times I'd walk off a course, there was nobody there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is when I need someone to talk to. And I say this to management companies who've like approached me to say, you know, we'd like you to come and work with us. And I'm like, I'm just not ready for that at the minute. I feel like I want to help people with the game. But I think it's, yeah, that's the low side of it. And which I think, which is exactly what how I want to help. When they get off a golf course, I want them to think, oh, I'll ring Dice. I want them to be able to do that and talk to me about what they've been through in that day. And, you know, some tournaments I might go and I'll say, like, no, I watched you today. You know, you did really well in this part, but I feel like this part of your game wasn't the best. Let's just go and do half an hour and have a bit of fun with it and enjoy it and maybe look at it a little bit differently. But we, you know, we're out there and we do give ourselves a hard time. The pros do give themselves a hard time, and they're striving for perfection. I just wish they realised it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it doesn't exist. And Tiger's as close to perfection as I've ever seen in any sport.
Yeah.
And even he was striving to get better. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I want to be regarded as like a mentor. I really do. I think that's a huge part of a young professional's career, to have somebody who's been there and done it. I used to play practice rounds with Darren Clark and Lee Westwood. I used to ring Chubby up. I used to ring Pete Cowan up. You know, they were my mentors, especially Pete Cowan. I could talk to him about anything. And that's kind of the relationship I want with my players as well.
Yeah, and what I love about that is it connects right back to the values that you held at the center, at the core of things in Asia, the sense of family and belonging and community and support, and then flipping that and wanting to create that for others through the game.
Absolutely.
And
I always think you need, like out the film, Meet the Parents, the circle of trust. The stronger your circle is, the better you're going to do. You've got four or five guys around you who you trust with everything. So your coach, your fitness trainer, your manager, your caddy, putting coach, whatever. If you've got a really strong circle, you're going to achieve something. If you're not happy with one of those, that whole circle's broken.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I always say to people, get your circle. Get your strong circle and you'll notice a massive difference. And you won't even know you've done anything different, but you really, psychologically, you'll have changed it.
Yeah, absolutely. So cool. So to close the show, I do want to ask you one quick favor, and then I want to get your social media links so people know where to follow you and to know where they can find you for those wanting to potentially work with you at your academy. But my son, Eli, who you met at Dr. Carl Morris's workshop, said, can you ask Simon when you stop recording advice for me? I just started the game and I love the game. And so instead of when we're not recording, I want you to just pass on a message to Eli right now. Some words of wisdom.
Now?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were going to stop recording.
No.
Say, Eli, just keep it simple and enjoy it. Honestly, don't get bogged down with all the technical spiel that everybody, oh, this, you should be doing this, bowed wrist, blah, blah. You swing it how you swing it. Find a way to make it effective for you and just go out and have some fun with it. Go and play some games on the course. Go and play games. Go and test yourself with your short game. Short game's a massive part of the game. So really get stuck into it and, yeah, just enjoy it. And do you know what? You'll look back at this in 5 years, 10 years, and just go, do you know what? I have enjoyed it. Or you might say, oh, I got too technical. I wish I'd listened to Simon.
Yeah, exactly.
But just enjoy it and keep it simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because anything inside of 50 yards, we do 18-hole match plays inside 50 yards around the chipping green.
Brilliant.
And he beats my ass most of the time.
You know what, though, Andy? You can't do enough of that.
Yeah.
Every single person I work with, I've got this guy's come up with this game, and it's a test, really. It's based on Dave Peltz on the spreadsheet. That's it.
Yeah.
And he based it on all Dave Peltz's data from years and all that. So so you do like a short chip, a long chip, a short pitch, a long pitch, short bunker shot, long bunker shot, and you've got the diameter, like the proximity from the hole, 3 foot, 6 foot, and then anything else. And it really gets you focused in, and it takes about an hour, but I do it every month with all the players.
Yeah.
Oh, if I can get it over to you, I'm going to send it to you because I want Eli to do it.
Yeah.
And I want him to video it and tag me in and send me the video and say, like, this is unbelievable. Because it really is. There's nothing to do with technique. It's literally learning the ability to play the right shot when you need to.
Oh, that's sweet. That's really cool. Well, Carl gave me the 10 by 10, which is finish off before you go play, taking 10 pitches from anywhere 30 to 60, 70 yards. Different lies, uphill, downhill, see how many you can get inside 10 feet.
Yeah.
You know, and then keep the data on it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And see if you're progressing and see if you're not. And if you're not, why aren't you? Maybe you need to do a little bit more work on it.
Yeah, exactly. So where can people find you on social media, Simon?
So Twitter, I'm on SimonDyson77. Okay. I don't really use Twitter that much. I find there's a lot of keyboard warriors on Twitter, especially in the UK. I don't know what it's like over there.
Yeah.
And then Instagram, I'm Simon Dyson Golf, which that's my main handle. That's the one that I use most days.
And you got a website now?
And then I've got a website, is www.elitegolfperformance.co.uk.
Okay, great. Well, again, I want to thank you for your time, Simon. I really appreciate it. And I think a lot of people will benefit from hearing about your journey and all the lessons that you've learned over the years.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Just stay on the line. I'm going to close off the show and stop recording. Everybody, thank you for listening to this episode with Simon Dyson, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
Thanks for listening to the Run Your Life podcast by Andy Vassily. To check out show notes, get some more information about Andy as well as his guests, head to our website, 21clradio.com.